Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have.
Hi, this is Jed Babin, former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for George H.W. Bush, contributor to the Washington Times and author of several books, including The BDS War Against Israel. And you're listening to Audrey Russo on Real Talk.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. The Obama administration continues its assault on free speech. This time, it's going after so-called climate change deniers. Will they succeed in this anti-American pursuit? And is the pro-life movement being weakened by the left or green evangelicals and their clever deceptions? Well, we're going to discuss this and more with my next guest. For my new listeners, Dr. Calvin Beisner is founder and national spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance. Dr. Beisner is a scholar on the application of ethics to economics, government, environmental stewardship, and public policy, a professor of interdisciplinary studies at Covenant College from 1992 to 2000, and of historical theology and social ethics at Knox Theological Seminary from 2000 to 2008. He has taught theology, apologetics, ethics, church history, economics, and other disciplines. He has written 8 books, including 4 books on population, resources, economics, and the environment, and has contributed to over 30 books and hundreds of articles. He has also testified before Congress as an expert witness on the ethics and economics of climate policy and has been a guest lecturer throughout North America, Europe, Africa, and Asia. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome back to Dr. Calvin Beisner.
Thank you very much, Audrey. It's good to be with you.
Well, welcome back, Cal. It's great to have you with us again.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
And we have a lot to cover here, and so we're going to jump right in. As is the MO of those who really loathe free speech, Mr. Obama, via his Attorney General Loretta Lynch, has again attempted to paralyze free speech. Their attempts to do so with the criticism of Islam failed, but being relentless haters of the First Amendment, they are now trying once again, this time with so-called climate change deniers. Now, A.G. Lynch stated recently that not only has she discussed internally the possibility of pursuing civil actions against so-called climate change deniers, but she has, and I quote, referred it to the FBI to consider whether or not it meets the criteria for which we could take action, end of quote. Cal, this appears to be a flagrant assault on free speech. Now, can you share where this is coming from? Is it Congress or organizations with influence in Congress?
Well, first, I'm glad to be able to say to you that I am not communicating to you from a prison cell.
Good.
I'm still free and still freely speaking. Where this really comes from is, I think, the very mistaken notion that there is some analogy between the skeptical approach to claims about dangerous man-made global warming, on the one hand, and the efforts by some tobacco companies from the 1960s through the 1980s and even into the 1990s to suppress scientific evidence of the harmfulness of tobacco smoking. The two scientific situations are hugely different from each other. Causal path of harm from tobacco smoking to disease was very, very clear. The evidence was overwhelming, and it was a rather simple matter. In contrast, when we come to the supposed danger of carbon dioxide emissions from burning fossil fuels, because those emissions supposedly cause global warming that supposedly will be so great that supposedly it will bring catastrophic results to human civilization and other life on Earth. Well, the scientific case for that is far from clear. That is, climate is, frankly, probably the most complicated natural system we've ever studied, with the probable exception of the human brain. There are thousands of climate feedback mechanisms that determine global average temperature over time, most of which we don't know the magnitude of, and a good many of which we don't even know the sign, meaning we don't know whether they increase or decrease any initial warming or cooling at the surface of the Earth. That means that the whole issue of how carbon dioxide affects global temperature and how global temperature affects ecosystems and human economies and human health and so on, all of those questions are just immensely complex, and we cannot make any clear path between carbon dioxide emissions and threats to human health. We can instead make a pretty clear path between CO2 emissions and improvements in human health. And here's how. It comes two ways. One, the energy that we derive from the fossil fuels from which we release CO2 emissions is itself an enormous help to human life. Energy runs everything that we do in the making of food, clothing, shelter, healthcare, transportation, communication, literally everything that we do. And the more you have abundant, affordable, reliable energy, the healthier your people are and the longer they live. And then secondly, as carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere rises, plant growth rises as well. That is, plants grow better in warmer and cooler temperatures. They make better, more efficient use of water, which means that they grow better in both wetter and drier conditions. They grow better in their soil nutrients. They make better use of soil nutrients. They resist diseases and pests better. So plants' ranges and their fruitfulness increase, and that means more food for everything that eats plants, which is all animals and human beings. So instead of the notion that, as with tobacco smoking, you have a very clear, straightforward, detrimental effect, instead, with the climate change issue, you have an extremely difficult, very, very complex, poorly understood set of mechanisms, and we actually have good evidence that there's more benefit than harm that comes from using fossil fuels and emitting CO2.
Well, so now we have, so we they go even further here. RICO, Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, was meant, of course, to combat organized crime. At a meeting in early February, for the listeners who are now aware of this, the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy, a panel of speakers made the case for applying RICO to individuals, corporations, nonprofits, and anyone else who dares to oppose the climate change consensus. Cal, it's almost perverse to me to use this to silence free speech, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Now, we do have to acknowledge, Audrey, and I certainly acknowledge this, that the First Amendment, which protects freedom of speech, does not protect fraud. Mm-hmm. Now, fraud is properly defined in law as a situation in which someone knowingly deceives another person in order to cause harm to that other person or benefit to the one who's doing the deceiving. That's fraud, okay?
Yes.
Now, where you tell what you think is the truth, even where it turns out not to be the truth, but where you tell what you think is the truth, that's not fraud. And the problem is that there are outstanding scientists on all sorts of different sides of the climate change controversy. There are those who think that that our adding CO2 to the atmosphere causes a whole lot of warming very rapidly, and it's going to be very dangerous, and governments need to act together to prevent that. There are those who think that it causes a moderate amount of warming, that it's going to be moderately harmful, that governments might want to act, but on the other hand, the acting to try to reduce that might actually cause more harm than the warming itself. There are those who think that it causes only a very tiny bit of warming that is not on balance negative and harmful to human or other life. There are scientists all over the map on this. And the notion that you would be able to make the case that some of them have knowingly presented what they themselves understood was false and have done it with the intent of harming others or enriching themselves. That is, the notion that you could prove actual fraud here is just absurd. What's really crucial to the health of scientific endeavor is vigorous, robust, wide-open debate. What we know from the history of science is that even ideas that have in the past been embraced by the essentially unanimous consent of all scientists, for example, the notion that peptic ulcers were caused by excess acid in the stomach, often from eating spicy foods, that notion prevailed for many decades until in the 1980s, a couple of Australian medical doctors kept thinking, we think it might instead be because of bacteria. And finally, one of them actually swallowed a cupful of a mixture that had a bunch of that bacteria in it. And sure enough, he got the ulcer. And eventually that led to the discovery that the vast majority of peptic ulcers are caused by a bacterium instead. And that led to that scientist and his partner receiving the Nobel Prize in medicine. So the health of science, sound science, requires robust, wide-open disagreement, wide-open debate, and you can't just say, look, this is the truth. Anybody who departs from this is somehow or other to be accused of fraud. That strikes at the very heart of science. That is what happened with Trofim Lysenko in the Soviet Union, who believed organisms develop, they evolve not through genetic inheritance, but rather through the inheritance of acquired characteristics. You can injure an organism, and that injury will be inherited by its offspring, and then by its, and so on. That was the dominant thinking in the Soviet Union, because Lysenko was supported by the political powers, by Stalin and Khrushchev. And that set Soviet biology back decades. We can't afford to see that kind of destruction of genuine science in our world today.
Exactly. And, of course, these are efforts of silencing dissent, which is very dangerous in a Democratic Republic. And
absolutely.
Yeah, and I believe that they are pursuing this under the premise of man-made global warming being settled science. And as you just shared, that's not correct. I'm curious because I find the fact that this attempt by the government and this administration to silence dissent. Cal, are you aware of any members of Congress that are addressing this egregious behavior, or are most so confused on the issue that they are willing to defer to progressive bullying tactics to protect, their careers?
Audrey, I hate to say it, but I'm not aware of any particular members of Congress who have spoken out against this.
Yeah.
However, I should say this. I really think that the notion that the Justice Department is going to wind up bringing any kind of either civil or criminal prosecution based on RICO or anything else against climate skeptics like myself, I think that notion is slim to impossible. It would be so difficult for that to be supported by the public. And if it really did begin to come closer, then I do think we would see many members of Congress, I trust, on both sides of the aisle, coming out saying this is a complete attack on freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of scientific inquiry. It's a very serious thing if it were really to come about, but I think that the odds are pretty slim for it to happen.
I agree.
I hope
so too. In one of your recent articles, and listeners, if you haven't read Cal's work, you must, the article titled Pollution and the Death of Babies, How Green Evangelicals Imperil the Pro-Life Movement. You share about the Evangelical Environmental Movement, EEN, which professes to be pro-life, and they've also launched their pro-life clean energy campaign. So, Cal, would you share about the EEN and...
Yeah.
As many on the left, we often hear projects that are the complete antithesis of what they are called. Could you share also about their pro-life clean energy campaign?
Yeah, the Evangelical Environmental Network is one of a variety of different creation care organizations, evangelical creation care organizations. And EEN's leadership professes to be pro-life, and I don't have any reason to think that they are not genuinely pro-life. I do, however, think that they're pretty badly confused over some issues. What you're referring to is the fact that they have launched just last month, February 8, what they're calling their pro-life clean energy campaign. It's a campaign that promises to organize, as they claim, 500,000 pro-life Christians to participate in efforts to curb the emission of carbon dioxide, which they're calling pollution, by demanding a switch from fossil fuels to wind and solar to, as they say, free our children from pollution all across America with 100% clean electricity from renewable sources by 2030. And it calls this campaign pro-life. Now, the reason they call it pro-life is that they think that there are some threats to human health and life that come from carbon dioxide emissions driving rapid and high magnitude global warming. Now, I've already discussed the fact that the scientific case for that is extremely complicated, and I think that it's actually very, very poor. I think the best empirical evidence instead is that adding CO2 to the atmosphere causes only a very small amount of warming, and it is not overall detrimental. In fact, I think the benefits of the energy that we derive, as well as the benefits of the fertilizing effect of the higher CO2 in the atmosphere on plants, actually far outweigh any risks that come from that. But EEN, anyway, wants to argue that since there is some threat to human health and life from the CO2 emissions, therefore it's pro-life to support the policies of the Obama administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, to force a reduction in CO2 emissions, especially from our power plants around the country. Now, I think that, in fact, one can make a better case that that sort of a position is anti-life, because in reality, the cost of replacing fossil fuels with wind and solar is so high that you could actually calculate far more deaths coming from the reduced prosperity of the American people, and therefore their reduced access to adequate nutrition and adequate medical care and so on. You can actually calculate far more deaths coming from that than from any risks associated with the CO2 emissions. But then besides that, what they're forgetting is that the very meaning of pro-life arose in the 1970s. The term was used to denote those who oppose abortion on demand and are trying to have a reversal of the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision in 1973 that essentially made abortion legal in all states at all times for any reason. Pro-life has to do with opposition to abortion, and unfortunately, the EEN, in a past campaign called its Mercury and the Unborn campaign, also claimed that that was pro-life, saying that mercury emissions were a threat to babies in the womb. Actually, they vastly exaggerated the risk involved in that. And in essence, there are no children put at risk of death because of that. The real risk is of a slowdown in neurological development so slight as to be detectable only by trained specialists that disappears at most by age 7. And even in those in whom it persists, it never exceeds about a half-point reduction in IQ, which is, frankly, a difference common in identical twins raised in the same household. Mm-hmm. But EEN said, look, if you're sympathetic to the EPA's intention to force a reduction in mercury emissions, then that means you are sympathetic to pro-life concerns. You're sensitive to pro-life concerns. And they named among the various different Congress people who they said were sensitive to pro-life concerns a number who actually had 100% pro-abortion voting records. And then they castigated as not sensitive to pro-life concerns members of Congress who had 100% pro-life voting records. Mm. The result of that, of course, was to obscure the meaning of pro-life, to divide the pro-life movement, and to make it more difficult to elect truly pro-life people to public office and to bring abortion under control and to end it in the United States.
Mm. Well, you know, we have just a few minutes left here, but I really want the listeners to hear this. You astutely give the ethical distinctions between abortion and pollution in your article. Would you share those with us, Cal?
Yeah, I think this is critically important. As you mentioned in introducing me, I've been an ethics professor in the past, and when I've taught ethics, I've always made sure that my students understood that proper ethical judgment always considers carefully both the intent and the outcome of our acts. But EEN's campaigns, both the Mercury and the Unborn campaign and the current pro-life clean energy campaign, those campaigns ignore that distinction and they twist the facts about the outcomes. First of all, the intent differs. In abortion, the intent is to kill a baby. In energy production, the intent is to provide energy people need to sustain life and health. And yes, there is some pollution as a byproduct of that, but it's an unintended risk. I intend to drive to work. I don't intend to get in an accident, but that's a risk that comes with doing that, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not condemned ethically for deciding that I'm going to drive to work. And then besides that, the factual outcomes differ between abortion and pollution coming from energy production. In abortion, the outcome of every successful abortion is a dead baby. In energy production, the outcome of the energy produced is enhanced human health and life, while the outcome of the pollution byproduct is, compared with the immediate death of babies in abortion, a slight reduction in health. Certainly not enough to outweigh the great increase in human health that comes from all the energy that you get from producing that energy from fossil fuels. So, you know, to call support for CO2 emission reductions pro-life is really to completely misunderstand the term, and it is to make very fundamental mistakes in ethical analysis.
Yeah, precisely. You're giving the distinctions. That was just brilliant. Cal, in essence, by drawing pro-life activists away from actual pro-life work and leading them instead into environmental causes closely tied to the population control movement, which sponsors abortion globally, isn't EEN really deceiving many sincere Christians?
Yes, I think it is. Now, this would be a great point at which to loop back to our discussion before of RICO, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, and the Obama administration's hope, perhaps, to prosecute people who question dangerous man-made global warming, as I do. You know, I think that EEN is deceiving people. I don't think that it's doing so intentionally. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference between fraud and simple disagreement.
Right.
We disagree with the EEN over these issues, and we think that they're deceiving people. We don't think that they're deceiving people intentionally. We think they're deceiving people because they don't understand the good science behind skepticism about climate change, because they don't understand the science behind mercury emissions and risks to the unborn, and because they also don't understand the fundamental ethical principles that I discussed a minute ago in terms of the difference between intent in abortion to kill a baby and energy production to enhance human health and life, and the difference between the factual outcomes in abortion, a dead baby, in energy production, healthier, longer-lived human beings, with, yes, some pollution byproduct, but for the most part, we know how to control that pollution and to prevent harm from it.
Right, exactly. We seem to have run out of time here, unfortunately, but this is a very important question. Where can the listeners follow and support your excellent work and that of the Cornwall Alliance?
Yeah, thanks very much, Audrey, for that opportunity. The place to go is cornwallalliance.org. That's cornwallalliance.org. And we have lots of excellent articles there, particularly on this issue, pollution and the death of babies. We've got that article. And we also have a call to protect the unborn and the pro-life movement from environmentalist deceit, a declaration by concerned pro-lifers. We also have a new documentary video called Where the Grass is Greener, Biblical Stewardship versus Climate Alarmism, that is available on our website under our shop or by going to wherethegrassisgreenerthemovie.com. That's wherethegrassisgreenerthemovie.com. So there or cornwallalliance.org, and then also our Facebook page, facebook.com/cornwallalliance.
And of course, as always, I'll have that information in my social networks and my after show. Thanks so much, Cal, for sharing your brilliant assessments with us. And we look forward to your return to the show. Until then, may God bless you, your work, and may God save America. Bye for now.